I'm Alden Bryant. I'm president of the Earth Regeneration Society, which is a nonprofit corporation out of Berkeley, California. And we came together in 1983 to bring together information about what is happening with climate change and be in association with scientists in many different fields. Over 20 fields are involved in the questions of soil, forest, and the carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, increasing cloud coverage, and flooding, and storms, tornadoes. All of these things are increasing in the snow cover in the higher latitudes, and in the Antarctic also, increasing snow cover. So we came together to look into this for a while and then realize that it's really an emergency situation. We need a tremendous counter program of rebuilding forests, our country and around the world, internationally. And where forests are dying, the problem is to put the right minerals in rock dust that has good minerals, like dolomite in the European areas. And Austria is doing the best job of any country right now. And taking dolomite rock and grinding it like talcum powder, very fine, putting it back on the soil. It's just a very much expanded fertilizer, essential to the soil, when the minerals have been used up over the last 10,000 years since the last glacial period. So this is the kind of thing we start running into and realizing we need a counter program, that we're halfway through the transition from the good weather we know into a next glacial period. That's what we've been pulling together over these years. And the counter program is something that has to go through national governments, the United Nations, as an international effort. And people associated with the ERS, I wore one of our little fun t-shirts. Let's say Earth Regeneration Society, reduce carbon, atmospheric carbon dioxide, and soil, forest, and energy work. And here's somebody with a shovel going to work. We've been in a lot of national, international conferences, and today is very much on, first we'll run through the main elements of the problem, what's happening, and then we'll talk about what other countries are doing to redevelop their forests and their soil and energy efforts. And we'll have some discussion back and forth on it. And this by way of announcement then. We've had two sessions, this is the third, and tomorrow at 4 o'clock is the last one. And tomorrow's is more on the philosophy, the ethics of it. Not only just our survival in the coming years, and our protection of ourselves, and trying to hold our food crops together in the shorter and shorter growing seasons. Not only this, but how do we relate to it? Because this is kind of advance on tomorrow. All of our society is like going one direction, you know, cutting down forests, using oil and coal, which produces a lot of carbon dioxide. So we're moving in one direction. We're faced with a situation that calls for moving totally in a different way, and we have never faced this as a human society that has written records and is organized. Of course, one of our standard jokes is, where were your relatives 122,000 years ago when this happened last time? There were very few people. So we're really very much all at risk if these conditions get worse and our crops cannot come through in the middle latitudes in the world. So that's why we had to get into this, and that's why Hertzfeld asked me to come up and be a participant here for this week. And by the way, Bishop Hertzfeld's on our Board of Advisors, and Theresa Hertzfeld worked with us for a year and helped prepare some of the legislation that is now out for review and that will later go to Congress when we finish the next rewrite. So again, by way of introduction, now, I just want to run through a general background that we've done twice before, but we'll do it quickly just to identify what we look at as the main elements of the picture. So we talk about soils. Am I in the way? Soils, the minerals in the soil have been used up steadily in the sense that they get eroded or leached or washed down to the ocean, and streams and rivers, so that by and large in this country, our main soil lab in New Knoxville, Ohio, that does over 1 million soil samples a year in the U.S. and elsewhere, the director says, take a rough kind of picture of soils being down, the minerals, down 25% to 40%. It's different in every area for different minerals, but this is a way to look at it. Now that is the basis for the dying forests in Europe and what is happening in parts of the U.S. We hear about acid rain a lot, but the general sense is that if the soils are very acidic already and acid rain builds up, it's going to start interacting and keep nutrients from the roots. But if the soil is fairly well up in its pH, fairly neutral, the acid rain is not as serious a problem. The basic thing is the minerals are down, and since we're mentioning, then we'll go to the forests. The forests are practically half cut down compared to 2,000 years ago, or dying out. You've all heard stories on what's happening in Europe, concern there. When we were in Hungary, we found most of the forests in Hungary are in dying condition, very bad shape. So bad that the Minister of Industry had a special meeting. We met with him on an arrangement and brought in the team from Austria that is putting good rock dust, dolomite rock dust back in the soil and bringing their forests back to life. And this is a group under their Academy of Sciences. The Austrian group and group in Hungary are now going to start working together and develop programs in Hungary and then see if that will spread over Central Europe and obviously other parts of the world. I got some photographs. We just start them around and arrange so everybody can see them. These are photographs that were given to us in Hungary first week of June at this international conference. That conference, as you'll see by the release, International Society for General Systems Research. Namely, people in different fields looking at some problem, the feedback loops, what happens if you do one thing, what's the impact of other parts of it. And that's sort of the general common sense approach. And one of their special sessions was on climate. So here's a picture in Austria of taking that rock dust from a tank truck, blowing it over as much of the forest you can reach from a road. That's one approach. Czechoslovakia flew 3,000 tons of rock dust by airplane over their worst forests in 1983.
Have they seen any improvement since they did that?
The results in Czechoslovakia went this way. They had mostly lime because they were thinking of the acid rain impact. And they wanted to bring the pH up to save the seedlings as the first thing, the first goal. And what they found was lime has some effect, but so many other minerals, 20, 30, 40 key minerals are needed for life in general, and the forest didn't come back very well from just a heavy lime application. And one of the main people in Czechoslovakia was at our session in Budapest, and we had a chance to discuss it. So they are going to keep in touch with a group in Austria and follow a much broader approach to remineralization. Here's a fellow from New Zealand, Keith Gray, that uses a number of kinds of rock dust. And this is just a table of a number of different kinds that he's experimenting with. Then the punchline. He grows some very big celery, looks beautiful, and so that's part of his display. Now, we just run through the cycle. The soil problem, the forests dying, and when the forests are not there, they're not there every day, and when the sun is out, to go through the photosynthesis and take out the carbon dioxide from the atmosphere. The forests are down, the CO2 builds up. So the line shows an increase in CO2, and we put numbers. The beginning of this century was about 280 parts per million in our atmosphere, which is a small amount, but look what happens. By now, it's about 347 parts per million, which is a very rapid increase like this. And that difference from this level or below back here, and let's stop. Think back in the middle 1800s. A lot of forests were cut out for agriculture in Europe and the US. And the CO2 is known to have taken some jump at that time. Now, this jump, the problem is, can we stop that increase? Can we level it off and try and bring it back down to this level? Because that's life as we've known it. Well, let's go on a bit. From the CO2 situation, when there is more CO2 in the atmosphere, you're going to have the following things happening. We drew this diagram, which is sort of a basic climate pattern. When you have more CO2, more carbon particles in the atmosphere, they're going to, as you know, the greenhouse effect, and sort of oversimplifying, the sun's energy warms the earth when it's hitting fairly directly and it's a hot day, and the earth radiates heat back. And that is near infrared wavelengths, which are absorbed by the carbon particles more than before, and some reflected back, but it's going to cause a warming area and more evaporation of water. Now, where does that moisture go? That's the trail to follow. The increasing moisture moves up, and then as it moves in the various wind patterns toward the North Pole or the poles, it hits cold masses of air as it goes up and condenses. So you have much increased cloud cover. Now that means the sun hitting, that's going to be reflected back. So that's a cooling effect on the earth right there. And the Dean of Climatology in England, Hubert Lamb, who built up their main center at East Anglia, that is one of the main things he's been pointing to during the 60s and 70s as our concern. Now, when that moisture goes further, it dumps as snow and builds up as snow and ice in the higher latitudes. The reports from satellite readings show that a peak was reached in 1973 in November of coverage in the Northern Hemisphere. And in 1985, it was exceeded by 18%. It was that much more coverage in North America, Europe, and the Soviet Union. It was 18 plus a few tenths in each area. So I tried a diagram, the snow building up and coming down further and deeper in the winter, and lasting longer into the spring. Then this opposite warming effect coming up and dumping, and the rapid increase that's going on. Any of you? Yeah.
Is that increased precipitation in the Northern Hemisphere have anything to do with the drought then that's prevalent in the Southern Hemisphere?
Yes. There's much more land mass in the Northern Hemisphere, much more moisture sucked up this way. And changing patterns in Africa in the last 10 years, a great deal of the drought and famine is related to this whole cycle. Whereas in the past, you'd say it was dependent on institutional things, like who owns the land, what are they producing, who eats it, who sends it on to Europe, and the local people are become wage workers and have inadequate food, these problems. That was almost all the picture 20, 30 years ago. But we feel that now this is behind, say it like maybe two-thirds, some very significant impact. And this now let's follow this around a little further. When you build up bigger and bigger snow areas, then you're going to have cold masses of air coming down, hitting the Midwest. A lot of people here are from like Chicago, where the all-time record colds year after year now for quite a few years. And of course, going all the way down to Florida, knocking out citrus. And okay. So when that cold fronts are coming down in greater and greater intensity, that's going to knock out food supplies in the sense that later storms and floods into the spring and earlier frosts, and then warming and freezing spells coming intermittently, knocking the buds off, or the blossoms. Like California lost about 90% of its almonds a few years ago. And I've been hearing stories from Minnesota and Wisconsin, similar. So that's why we just drew this arrow here in food. So that is, and so we drew it this way, it said weather. The CO2 increase means weather, faster and different impacts of hot and cold periods and greater extremes, which is leading, which is indicated by, or is the part of it is, the increasing rain patterns, Salt Lake coming up, the Great Lakes coming up, the greatest floods Maine ever recorded was in January of this year. Some of you read about that or know about it. California had 50,000 people flooded out a year ago. And in our story, they tell us that one more day of heavy rain in that region would have brought the floods over the dikes and knocked out our whole the city of Sacramento. They were ready to dynamite the dike on the other side and give up about 20,000 people to flooding to save Sacramento. And I checked that out with two of the officials that I know in Sacramento, and they knew that that was ready to go. Now that's one kind of condition. See, now that has to do with the rain and this heavier and heavier precipitation. You got more moisture coming up and it comes down. So the snow buildup, we've mentioned, the ice. When I was in Europe, I had four and a half days in England, and the people there are much more clear on it. They're clear that the snows are lasting longer into the spring, they're deeper. Of course, they have different latitude than the way that we do. And just even a taxi driver was, we're talking about it, and I asked him, so what's happening? He says, Ice Age is coming. He wasn't fooling around. And then another sign of things. There's a bestseller in the bookstores in England now on something about the third millennium, written by a woman, Eileen McCulloch. It was done a popular novel in this country. But that's published in England, not the U.S. And the story is, what's happening in the U.S. around 1910 and 2010 and 20, when we're into a glacial period, we're trying to survive and things are getting worse and worse. And that's what the book is about. And now, Europe as a whole has had some much more intense things happen, like earlier this year. There were periods when no trains were running, too much snow, and people couldn't go to work, very serious impacts. So I go back and cover part of the general picture. Here, this is going to now look at the 115, 120,000 years back to the previous turnaround from a nice interglacial, the CO2 coming up and going into this whole cycle and building up the period and going into the long glacial period, coming back here, the CO2 coming back, and here we have about 10,000 years of just minor variation. At the end of the 10,000 plus, it goes up fast, and that's the 280 to 347, and it's heading up this way. So this turnaround point is in the neighborhood of 330, 335, in that kind of range. However, the ocean core measurements and comparing isotopes, the methods have been used in different science research, is 500-year increments, so that it could have gone up higher and come down again. But this is the best I can pass on to you at this time. Now, how many of these cycles have we had? That's why we drew this diagram, or whatever you want to call it, showing that we've had about 22 of these cycles, according to the latest information of people in the geology field. If anybody here knows more about it, well, I'm more of in a coordinating position and I'm just open to listening. And we noticed that they run from about 70 to 110,000 years each. They're not anything exact at all. And the volume of ice, anybody know what kind of units they measure the world's ice volume? Millions of cubic kilometers. It's time to think of, well, what is that? Well, the numbers run from about 30 to 70, and we're down around 30. And when the ice is a mile deep around New York, like back here, 18,000 years ago, as it melted off, it was about 70. And when there's that much ice on the northern hemisphere and the South Pole, and you know that at this time about 90% of the world's ice is on the Antarctic. When there's that much ice out here, what happens to the oceans? Where'd all that water come from? The ocean goes down about 350 feet at the peak of the glacial period, when the most ice is on the land masses. Think what had happened to the Mediterranean. See, because the mouth at the Straits of Gibraltar is not that deep, I'm told, and so the Mediterranean has very little water in it, sort of like a small lake. Now you can figure out, where was the city of Atlantis?
Ephesus is 15 miles from the sea, and in biblical times, it was a seaport. That's not too many years ago.
Well, let's see, something I don't know very much about, but people have put this point that when the Mediterranean water is down, there's a very different life there. Well, that's as far as we've gone. But that illustrates the nature of the glacial period as the ice is building up across here, and it's building up from this kind of situation. And it's building up, and here's one last point on that. When snow cover comes down far enough, it's just going to stay and not melt off in the summer. And then it keeps building and keeps building. And those are our concerns. And that's why we need the counter program to try and stabilize it.
I have a question.
Yeah.
Now, you're aware of this cycle and the fact that this is occurring. What factors then, you know, you're talking about a 70,000 to 110,000 year cycle, what factors cause that to be reversed?
Well, if you're so, okay, let's start the simplest thing. What happens when the glaciers come down and move through the mountain areas and are grinding up rock? There's a tremendous outflow of this fine glacial dust, and that's a tremendous mineral impact back on the earth.
Soil.
It's called Lewis, Lois, L-O-E-S-S, the glacial dust. And so that slowly has tremendous outpouring with streams and rivers coming out under the glaciers, moving it out, drying, blowing around a good part of the world, and then the volcanoes down like in the Azores area throw a lot of good mineral dust back up. In the U.S., for example, some of our research people came back and said there are very great deposits of this at Lois, from the Midwest all the way down through Louisiana. And the first 5 feet are pretty much leached out, so they're not so good. But if we were to dig below that and bring that up, that's exactly what's needed back on the soil. That's just one side of the picture. Now, why hasn't this whole cycle been in the media in the U.S.? There is, let's put it this way, in the 60s and 70s, some of the leading people in the field knew we were moving into cooling and wrote about it. There's a number of articles in the journals in those times. One fellow named George Kukla had several articles in exploring moving into the next glacial period. Then in August of 1974, the CIA Research Department issued two reports, about 30 pages each, describing how the climate is changing, we're going into cooling, it's going to destroy food supplies, and it's going to destabilize governments. Their report was prepared because their responsibility is to inform Congress of what is happening and all kinds of issues. 2 years later, October 76, there was a special meeting in Washington. A special meeting where people came back from the Club of Rome session, the Law of the Sea session in Europe, and they had a high-level group in Washington, probably including some in the National Security Council. And there was a decision made at that time. They do not want a broad discussion of the whole cycle out in front of the public for a number of very important reasons to them. Therefore, put up a cover story and don't let it out. The cover story was CO2 is causing warming. That was clearly understood. They said it just causing warming, melt the poles someday and raise the oceans, it's way off. That means, like, cut it right here and keep the rest of the cycle out of the main science journals and out of the media. I'll give you one example. There was a meeting in the San Francisco at the Fairmont Hotel in 1984 of the International Association of Energy Economists, about 300, 350 people. One of the sessions was on climate. I gave the main paper there. I used to be a corporate budget director, and I'm a member of that sort of organization in this country. I gave the main paper on CO2 as a full system. Others dealt with just minor aspects of what's happening. At one of the larger workshops there, I spoke to some of these questions. And right away, a man at the podium jumped over the mic, and this was the chief economist for Chevron Oil Company. And he gave the perfect can story. He says, we know that CO2 is causing warming. It's going to melt the poles some, it'll raise the oceans a little, but it's way off in the future, and you don't have to change any of the coefficients in your models now. Speaking to economists, and we're dealing with oil and more international markets. So that was a perfect statement of this position as of 1976. The next morning, and this is the more interesting part of the story, his boss, the chairman of the board of Chevron Oil, gave a main address. And we talked afterwards and discussed some of this, and he says, I don't know about all this warming and cooling, but I want you to give your stuff to our research group to look at. He said he was not sitting in that 76 meeting, apparently. He was not running this cover story. And he felt more responsible for his industry and his firm, and he had to look at everything. Now, let's switch over to somebody that one of our participants knows well, Dr. Bertrand, Professor Bertrand Schultz in Nebraska, who is chairman of, or director of their Academy of Sciences. He's also director of their main geological institute, or one that deals with a lot of these subjects, Tertiary Quaternary Research Institute. He is one of our advisors, a participant in papers we gave a year ago at science meetings, and is somebody who's been in many countries over the last 30 years looking at these situations. And his paper a year ago was, we are moving into glacial conditions. Where was I? He's... We mentioned him. Oh, yeah. Bertrand Schultz. The tie-in is that Schultz is an international figure of first level. People in the oil industry give him grants for his institute to do their research because they want to know what's going on. Also, let's digress to one other aspect of his life. We first heard about him a few years ago, and so our group and his, we were started communicating. We were on the phone for about 45 minutes the first time. And I asked him, why haven't you been before Congress? With your background experience and knowing what is happening. He says, they won't let me testify. And I said, why is that, of course? And he pointed out that if he were to testify at a congressional hearing, there's no member of that hearing that would be willing to go back to the constituents and talk about such a heavy subject where it's not a major movement in this country yet. and does not want to be out in front and having to deal with the conflicts, especially the conflict about saying the group that's saying it's just warming. Then if they don't go back, what happens? They don't discuss it, and it's in the record for the hearing. Then they can be accused later of not being responsible and dealing with a serious problem. So they're kind of caught. So they don't let Schultz testify. They call him up and ask him what's going on. So that's the nature of the last 3-4 years. So that brings us through a number of things. Now, what's this little diagram? I wanted to say the following. That decision in 76 to run a cover story has very important reasons behind it. But I've drawn it this way. There's one side of this. That meeting was primarily pulled together by the Oil Investors Association. It includes Rockefellers, Rothschilds, Scripps, and others. And in the Scripps family, it's newspapers, there's tremendous oil holdings. A man who's a scientist who's married into the Scripps family, who's an integral personal part of that association, Roger Revelle, man in his 70s now, was the main person putting forward we better run just a warming story. And there's been about 4 lieutenants or people working and assisting in control of government agencies in the main computer center in Colorado to run a just warming only formula, program, and statements. Now, and then there's the, for 10 years, federal money through the Department of Energy, or Environmental Protection Agency, for 10 years, money has only gone to people that say it's just warming, and then they do their own research. No funds have gone to people of dealing with the whole cycle, like Schultz or Professor Kenneth Watt at University of California, Davis, who's an international figure in this stuff. They've even, through the efforts to maintain that position, the retirement of Hubert Lam in England out of the institute that he built up for most of his life. They forced his retirement 10 years ago and brought in someone saying it's just warming and we do our work under that. And they put U.S. Department of Energy money into that institute in England. And that was part of the deal. And had a number of Congress members in the U.S. involved in that. Now, why? How long are we going to run? We start to about 11:30, 11:45, something like that. Okay. Why is it so important to a few people in top policy positions? Why is it so important to keep a warming only and do not allow the full discussion to come before the American people? There's 2 kinds of reasons were brought out in various workshops we've held and people around the country discussing this. One, the oil and coal industry doesn't want to have cut back. And it's essential we reduce fossil fuel because it produces so much CO2 when you burn it. And it means going to alternatives, good solar electric, wind electric, gasoline for fuel, hydrogen fuel, whatever the range of things could be. And we've known since 76 that we could power this whole country from solar electric power plants in the New Mexico and the Southwest. And the designs and the engineering firms were there to build this back in 76. And I think Eastern Washington, Eastern Oregon, in the Okanagan. Back in 76, the analysis was they're only about 5% less sun hours than New Mexico. And you're thinking, how much sun during the year to run a solar electric power plant? Well, our State Department Water Resources joined up with a big engineering firm, Wismer and Becker, Sacramento, and one of the top designers in the world, Professor Otto J.M. Smith of Berkeley. Was an international figure, an advisor in electric power systems. They joined up to build a first plant in California to provide their own electricity to pump water in the state. And for 3 years, they tried to get that project through and were totally blocked off in Washington by top-level nuclear and oil interests that we don't want any competition from solar electric power plants, like 100 megawatts. Remember, nuclear plants anywhere 2, 3, 4, up to 1,000 megawatts of this kind of range. Well, that's so there is a good alternative energy type of technology that's there, that's available, and can be used as part of this effort to bring down stabilized carbon dioxide in the effort to bring it back down. In fact, have any of you heard of the there is a 5-megawatt plant. It's a smaller one. It's down near San Diego. It's fully operating now. It's doing a fine job. And the small reflectors. And building up in a big area. So this is, if you were buying electricity from there, you'd pay about the same as you would for a coal-burning power plant, which is lower than oil or nuclear. Now that's owned by LeJet Energy Company out of Abilene, Texas. As some of us were discussing this morning and yesterday, why aren't they building those all over the Southwest? And the manager there, when I called him a year back, he said, you got to call our vice president of public relations down in Abilene, Texas. Namely, this is not something we can discuss. Namely, that little plant is an experimental thing that an oil company probably put in to have it there if they need more of it later. But there's no plan to develop this as a major thing in the U.S. at this time. Now, how could a big oil company do that? Namely, there has to be some kind of national plan for transfer, keep people working, and keep supplying the energy so it's a smooth transition. Now, that's where the legislation that we've been preparing as we're trying to fill that need of legislation that covers the transition to emphasize remineralizing soils, rebuilding the forests, bringing down the carbon dioxide and stabilizing climate and reducing this area. So this, to put it in a simple piece of paper, that's what we've been doing in workshops.
Maybe I was daydreaming, but I want you to retell us what the connection was between the problem, as you outlined it, that there are two groups of scientists. One say we're going into a warming trend, one say we're going into a cooling trend. Your group says we're going into a cooling trend, but you pointed out that it appears that the government, as influenced maybe by oil and nuclear interests, are trying to sell the public on the idea that we're going into a warming trend. Is that correct so far as I've said?
Basically, I'll
Now, what's the relationship then? I thought you were going to tell us why the government is trying to sell that idea that we're going into a warming trend, and how does that fit in with neglect of our government to spend money on solar energy and experimentation and continuing to push the nuclear and oil interests?
Well, that is one excellent way to put a question. That's good.
I don't know if I said it right.
That's fine. We've been living with this and bringing and working on this stuff now since 1980. All right, to start with, let's go back to why is this so important that the government position was struck in October 1976? Why did they go to such pains take advantage of an institute in Colorado and bring in political leaders from around the world for 6 or 7 months? They stay for a week and get a heavy indoctrination about how it's just warming. CO2 is causing warming. They push this as an international policy that hard. And there's been total restriction of any articles, full articles, getting into the two main science journals. Now, why is it that important? The oil and the oil industry is just one part of it. That's their problem. They can't just shut off all of a sudden, of course. The main thing is the food policy of the U.S., and here's where I came down. Well, let's here take some information from an article back about 10 years ago. Food as a policy. Now, in the time of the change in Chile, the U.S. Congress restricted sending military equipment to Pinochet in Chile. At the time of the tremendous wave of killings, I don't know, what was over 10,000 people, some very, very big thing. At that time, our Congress said, don't send any military and weapons to that government. On the other hand, groups under the executive and the State Department continued to do so by means of giving large amounts of surplus food and commodity credit corporation credits to the government of Chile. They sold that to their people, used the money, came back to the U.S. and bought weapons from the U.S. weapons manufacturers. So that's how food was used as a very important maneuver or lever or a weapon in the international scene. Now this was happening all around Asia and Central America and South America and a number of places. Here are some of the figures. It was called PL-480, which had to do with surplus food to other countries that needed it very badly. So they started at one time the PL-480 allotments. Chile was getting 35 million out of the total 50 million in Latin America. Then it went up to as much as 60 million a year. Then Congress came back and tried to stop it. And this is what Carl Finbow has been discussing in the relation of the executive, Congress, and the Constitution and the courts. Congress said you can only send, 70% of all these food shipments have to be to countries that are on the United Nations list of worst hit countries. And Chile was not on that list. So this was under Kissinger as head of the Department of State at that time. What they did was the executive got Congress to increase the total food shipments around the world from 1 billion up to 1.6 billion. Therefore, they could still go on sending as much as they had been to Pinochet in Chile. So this is the kind of history of this movement between the executive and Congress. And that's why I put down here food in the 60s and in the 70s was used for weapons and these kinds of exchanges for the most dictatorial governments. And this was a question of U.S. control of these regions in the world from a certain point of view, namely multinational corporations and their investments and their control and the way in which they wanted to exert that control. So that's illustrated here in this position struck on this problem. Now, what's the opposite? If a general consciousness in this country is aware of the whole thing, how rapidly it's moving, and the rest of the world is equally aware, think of the kind of cooperation that would be taking place among countries in the world for a global movement on soil and forest and CO2 stabilization. Think of the kind of cooperation that would be taking place. And it would change these policies significantly. So in effect, they're saying we may lose some of our control if there's a kind of cooperation going on around these basic climate problems. So, hence in 1976, this warming only position. Now, what did they do? Here's something that we can all visualize very clearly. You've seen weather temperature measuring stations. Anybody know how many there are in the U.S.? Guess, throw out a figure. 11,000, 600, 700, something like that. Over 11,000. But how many of those are in metropolitan areas where you have the heat effect of a big city? It's known as a metropolitan heat island effect. It's very significant. So if you want to know what the temperatures are in a more global sense, you've got to go outside of big cities. There's only about 270 stations. They're really out and away. Now, there's one federal agency came up with a list of 28 that, in a way, best reflect the U.S. So Professor Kenneth Watt at Davis took those and did a computer model and analysis of 40 years and shows that there's a much more rapid cooling in the U.S. in the last 40 years than in any of the current science journals. Now, his article has not yet been published, but it's been circulated around the world and is having significant effect. But now let's be a little more, go into the details. Some areas are warmer and some are far colder. California, Oregon, and Washington have stayed a little on the warmer side and had more warm air coming up from the southern areas. There was a spot in Montana, and that's kind of moved over into Minnesota. All the folks in Minnesota have been telling about warmer winter and warmer summers. So here's a spot that has a warming bit as the regions are changing irregularly, but changing more and more. The cold, of course, has been coming down more, as we said, in the Midwest into the Far East and down to Florida. But then within that, as you have more snow cover and more warming both, and they're coming closer together, what happens to the wind patterns in between? More temperature difference. So you get more tornadoes and windstorms and heavy rainstorms and the whole set of things.
What is the CO2 level? Does it have any relationship to the ozone?
It's almost entirely a separate situation.
It is.
And O3 and the amount of O3 and the very high elevations of the ozone is almost totally separate from the amount of CO2 in the world's atmosphere from the sea level on up.
Our government is spending a lot of money on research in the ozone.
Well, it's a very significant problem.
Yeah.
I got to wear a hat all the time. I can't go out in the sun. I have a tendency toward skin cancer. And I understand there's a lot of this going on. Namely, there's a little more radiation coming through than there used to be. But I don't know very much about that. Well, so now you get down here and you say this was the meaning for some of the power centers in this country that have been conducting firstly what happened through Chile and then what happened and what's going on in Central America and this whole Iran gate and this whole material of background groups determining policy and having sufficient control to do it. Now what's the other side of it? Namely, opening up the whole picture for public awareness and involvement and going for a counter program. Now, I drew that in sort of this arrow in a brighter color, sort of the sign of hope, of challenge, and of what we're working on. Our sense is, let's go for it in every way we can. Now, that means support for third world countries and their forests, because that's where a lot of the best and the fastest growing forests are. Now that was my particular paper, along with two other people, in Budapest at this international meeting. It's called Economics of Climate Stabilization. And it's putting forward some problems that have never been put into a science paper before in proceedings of any of these meetings. Namely, saying on the global basis, how do you raise forests the fastest to get this effect? The soil and the forest work a lot. Now here's some kind of numbers to keep in mind. We didn't know anything about this a few years ago. We went to some of the best forest people in the country, or Berkeley and the forestry department, like Paul Zinke, Professor Zinke. We asked him, what's a net growth rate of forests? How do they behave? Because a lot of trees are dying, others are growing. And he says, net growth rate, think in terms of cubic meters per hectare per year. That's the units they use. And there was somebody here from England, a forester, who just left a few days ago, and he's familiar with these kinds of figures. Cubic meters per hectare per year, by about 2.4 acres per hectare. Want to guess? What's the net growth rate of a forest? Just, you know, look around. How fast is that forest growing? Any numbers? Well, that's where we were too a few years ago. Well, just look, it's not in the school system. Kids don't hear this. People don't hear it. About 15 down in the tropical areas. About 15 cubic meters hectare per year. Then if you go up to Finland, it goes down to 2, approximately 2. Because you have very cold weather, very poor soil, and therefore the growth rate is very, very slow. Now, if you're going to deal with a program like this on a global basis, use a figure, he says, of about 10. And that would be in the temperate zones, in the third world countries, and of course, U.S., Soviet Union, the rest.
Is that net growth rate?
Net. Yeah, you got them dying, you got them growing, and you got to know what's the net. So out of Budapest came one of the logical questions. How do you set up a model for a global movement on this stuff? So we started putting together words like a CO2 budget, global program. So that you think in regions, and in each region, what are they doing to increase the CO2 or bring it down? What are they doing? What effect are they having in the next year and the next year? One of our people is from Africa, from Sudan. He has a PhD in economics, and he's teaching at the University of California, Davis, currently. Lakotong. So he sat down and drew out and put Africa into 9 regions, for example, of which are sort of logical forest, desert, and jungle-type regions. But this idea of a CO2 budget is a very powerful thing, because it takes in everything you're doing with transportation, with your crops, and with forests, and with soil work. And what kind of manufacturing fuels are being used in industry. And to go back one more step, a year ago, the time of the science meeting in Philadelphia, American Association of Advancement of Science, the city of Philadelphia itself, they brought together about 60 leaders in the area and set up a model program along this line and set up some people to work on it. And it's kind of holding, and it's slowly moving along. But they wanted to be a model city of this sort.
Alden?
Yeah.
What cooperation or what interest has the Orient shown? I lived in Bangkok for a couple of years, 80 and 81. The slash and burn is phenomenal that's going on and destroying the teak forest as well as other indigenous forests. People are moving off their small farms. Well, many of them are moving, but still there's a tremendous amount of small farming slash and burn that goes on in that country and is destroying their forests and their soils at a rather astounding rate. Are you getting any interest in your organization from countries in the Orient?
Yeah, when you raise a question like this, we say that it's important to look at both sides. Namely, what's being cut down and which companies are doing it, and then what's the movement to come back. And there are a lot of stories we've run into of, say, the U.S. A lumber corporation going out, say, to a village area, a very fine hardwood forest. I think one in Singapore. The villagers knew that this was their lives in the forest, and they did not want any of those forests cut down. And it was going to be a real confrontation. So this corporation, with its headquarters in San Francisco, arranged the government to take all of those villagers out and put them in a compound concentration camp area at a great distance, went in, clear cut, and took most of their hardwood out of the area, and then let them come home again. Now, I heard about this story from an engineer who sat in a management meeting in San Francisco where one of the executives in the company said, well, these villagers just don't know what's good for them. You know? Just handled in that way, with absolutely no sense of the human meaning, what it means to their culture, their lives, and all the rest of it. So there's all kinds of examples of cutting forests in a big way. Now, in response, China had, I've heard figures from 8 to 11, 14% of their total area is forest. It came down for a while since the 40s, and now they've been on another big campaign to rebuild their forests in a large scale. Now, India. Some people from Australia and people from India have been spending a lot of time together. There's an organization called Men of the Trees, with St. Barbara Baker out of Australia, starting early in the century. One of the founders of that, a woman, Betsy Ann Coates, has spent a lot of time with Gandhi and with leaders in India. And some of our climatologists in this country have spent time in India talking with their government, saying if you don't rebuild your forest, you're going to lose an awful lot of your people. There's so much forest down and out in India that they've lost the timing and quality of their monsoon periods. And the type of drought and desertification is going on very rapidly. But the counter movement is that Gandhi himself has participated in meetings. A number of his government ministers are very much involved in this, rebuilding the soils and the forests, particularly reforestation. So there's an awareness and a movement in a direction. Australia has three or four places where they are actually doing a lot with ground rock, rock dust, showing the strengthening of the trees, they're more resistant to fire, they're more resistant to pests. And when you remineralize soil and bring it back up, you don't need pesticides. And a lot of farmers know that now. The crops are much stronger and resist to pests to a great degree. Just think what that means for California, we're the biggest user of pesticides in the world, I guess. So that is something that's being shown in Australia and New Zealand.
What about Brazil and the Amazon?
It's all downhill, isn't it? Well, now let's take Brazil. We're told that the president of Brazil would be glad to be one of the leaders internationally in this kind of movement. One of our associates is an active person in Brazil and is also on the board of directors of an international body on environment, Environment's Liaison Center, which is contact with somewhere between 2,500 and 3,000 organizations around the world, non-governmental organizations, other groups. And he's on that board. He's just back and wrote us a letter last month saying he was trying to bring forward the full climate cycle and the problems here, but he found there was some very heavy political resistance from a few people saying it's just warming, we don't want to hear any other talk. And that pressure is on, and he wrote to us saying, give us every kind of information you can for the people in Brazil, and he and his associates, to come back and try and open this up more fully. Now that's the climate side. As for cutting down forests, well, part of our effort was to circulate an article from Spain that had translated that listed about 8 international corporations in the US, Japan, Italy, a number of places that are in the Amazon cutting out the forests at a great rate. And that's under that policy of moving so many people from the lower part of the country up in there and say, great farming, great cattle industry. And the soil's no good within a year or so. And it's a very serious thing. A lot of them are moving back to the southern Brazil. That's how much, that's all we've heard, Kelly. Well, let me give you a crack at these slides. Thanks very much. There's four of them, and they just little diagrams. Can you all see that all right? Here. I'm trying to focus in a little more sharply here. Okay, here's the main idea. You see the CO2 curve? Bringing it up to 345 at 84, and the idea to bring it over and down. Over here is one of our original ideas for this kind of full cycle situation. The warming action of CO2, the heat in terms of British thermal units, BTUs of heat going up, and the warm, moist air going out, movement toward the poles, the cloud formation, heat loss to outer space, coming down of snow and ice. So what goes up here is moisture, comes down here is snow and ice. You would have cold fronts moving from the polar areas toward the equator, and here loss of food production. How many people you heard about Canada in the sense they lost 3/4 of their wheat, I think it was 1984 or 5, in combination of some hot spells coming up and the cold spells and shorter growing season. So Alberta and Saskatchewan, where conditions were such they lost about 3/4 of their wheat. Anybody see that anywhere? We didn't either, except one source that was sent to us. The Christian Science Monitor had a half-page article on it describing it. Then I went up the next year and met with farmers in Alberta, and they told me, yes, they've been through it, and they were paid by the government $49 a head per year to pay the higher price of feed, keep their cattle alive. And they were told you cannot kill more than 6% of your herd due to the price of feed. That's just part of this whole cycle building up. Now here, when you have more snow and ice on the poles, and you press down, what's going to happen? Well, the pressure starts coming out the middle due to the structure, the tectonic plates of this earth. So you get more earthquakes and volcanoes. We're aware of Managua and Mexico City and St. Helens and a lot of these events, small earthquakes in the West Coast. So that's this part of the cycle. Well, so much for that. Comment anytime you want. This to show you the kind of work that the people associated with this effort, what they've been through. Here's the CO2 curve. Here we are out here now. This is us at this point. You go back 140,000 years. So this is the 10,000 or so years of good weather that we know. Here's where CO2 is gone. It was down as low as below 200. It stayed long in here during that period. Here is the period of the last turnaround. And this was drawn in having a rough idea of the heights, the limits, and the time periods. So this was just put in. And it's so explained in the articles where this appeared. Here's the kind of thing on global ice volume. You see, back about 18,000 years when the ice was at a peak. And here it is coming down into our last 10,000 year period. And it's coming back up again.
This is determined by ocean core testing?
Ice? Yeah, the ice volume is pretty much on ocean core tests.
Okay.
And then here's a picture on the temperature movements across these periods.
This is such a long time span. What is there to determine whether this isn't such a natural function?
For about 40,000 years, this period, the best data is from bubbles in the ice up around Greenland. They go down deep in the ice mass, take the bubbles from the atmosphere at that time, and analyze them for CO2 content.
Yeah, are you putting forward that this trend that's happening now is being caused by man and its consumption?
No. So what we're saying here is that these are natural cycles that have happened as the soil minerals get used up, as the forests die out. Then you have this kind of motion, the increase of CO2, and you go through this kind of a cycle. So it's a natural cycle. Our objective is to say, put that rock dust back in the soil, rebuild the forest, go to alternative energy, and damp this out by using natural techniques to damp out the glacial conditions. Now, what's just happened?
Dinner. Lunch time.
All right, as of this moment, we close the session.
Thank you.
But as you're walking out the door, here is the kind of general systems approach, showing the main elements and all the feedback loops, and this was done under Society of General Systems Research.